Welcome one and all to the Track One Side One podcast. I'm your host Gaz Jones. And today's guest, well, he's a Director of Clinical Development, an Honorary Research Fellow. He holds a PhD in HIV Neurology. He's a total gearhead, a guitar shredder, and an all-round mega dude. I'm talking about Dr. Michael Keegan. So without further delay, enjoy today's episode, and I'll speak to you at the end. Cheers.
I'm feeling kind of basic today. Top five side ones, track ones.
You are listening to the Track One Side One podcast with me, your host, Gaz Jones. The greatest. Each week, a guest picks their five favorite album opening tracks, and we dissect, discuss, and debate each one. So let's put on our classics and have a little chat then, shall we? Okay, we're live, and sat in front of me via the means of Skype, we've got the lovely Michael Keegan. How are you, my friends?
Hello, mate. I'm doing very good, thank you.
Kind of before we start, mate, I was wondering how hard was it just to get it down to five songs?
It is hard.
That's the point.
Yeah, exactly. No, I do. And for the last 10, 13 years, something silly like that, we do these little geeky music nights with a little crowd of us. And so we always bring a song along and you introduce why you like it, you know, what the sounds are, the history of the song, that kind of thing. And so I've sort of built up a little bit of a top five, top 10 over the years doing that. So that helped a bit.
Let's crack on with it. What's your first track you want to talk about, mate?
So my first track is by my favourite band of all time, my favorite album of all time, and I think it's one of those albums that is just perfect. So by that I mean fantastic songs, fantastic attitude, the sounds were right, the mix of the musicians were right, everyone gave their part to this. So it the song is Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses off of Appetite for Destruction.
Absolutely wonderful choice, mate. 1987,
and this for me was the biggest thing that hit before the grunge explosion. Mm-hmm, yes. You know, this felt like proper music in a decade that maybe was a bit more candy floss. There obviously was some great stuff going on, but I wasn't exposed to it, and this was my first kind of big one. A friend had made me some mixtapes when I was about 13, 14, and it had like Alice Cooper, like Poison, and you know, those kind of like Def Leppard and Bon Jovi and that kind of stuff, and it was like, yeah, this is cool. And then he gave me a couple of post-Aussie era Black Sabbath albums, and I was like, yeah, that's cool too. And then when this song hit, I literally remember where I was when I heard it. And so, you know, it was like, whoa, okay, mind blown. 14-year-old Mike, that was it. I didn't even know they existed until probably, I don't know, January 1988, when a friend gave me just, you know, a copy on tape. Because back then, you'd get, your mate would buy an album, you'd buy an album, and you'd buy a blank tape, and you'd copy it for each other. That's just how it worked. I might have broken copyright laws, but I've bought that album about 10 times since.
Same here.
Yeah, I was sitting, my mum had gone into some market, or it might even have been a car boot sale or something, and I was sitting in the car with my Sony Walkman, with my dodgy orange fuzzy like foamy headphones on. I put it on, and honestly, that from the first moment, that was it was just chills. It was better than anything I'd heard, you know, up until that point. I was raised on a really cool diet of the Stones and Stevie Wonder and Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Nice.
That first bit where Slash is just starting in your in your ear with that delay on his guitar and that descent line, and then everything just hits in perfectly. Izzy's building some of the tension on some guitar lines, Duff and Steve coming in, and then that howl, what you think is a police siren, and then you go, hang on, that's a voice.
Yeah.
I'm getting chilled now thinking about it, you know? It just, it kicks in, and then the sound is there, and it sets the tone for the whole album. Everybody, to me, brought their own vibe to that. So Duff was punk, you know, that's what he did. Yeah. Stephen brought this swing with this, what sounded like he was hitting like cardboard boxes, but he brought this weird, this groove that they never had after that. They had much more straighter drummers, you know, after Stephen's. And they did that guitar weaving thing that I'd learned from listening to the Stones when I was younger. Mm. Keith Richards always goes on about how they do the guitar weaving. They're not playing the same thing. And then obviously bands like Aerosmith did the same thing, and, but it had that. And then Axl's voice, man, the attitude that boy had. Mental.
I heard there's an incredible story. I don't know if it's true. I really hope it's true. But apparently the title came from when Axl was hitchhiking to LA, and on the last leg, and the trucker dropped him off in the middle of LA and uttered the phrase "Welcome to the jungle."
I heard a similar thing. That's because he came from what was it, Indiana?
Indiana. Yeah.
You know, and I think Izzy had come from Indiana as well. They were friends back then, along with I think Shannon Hoon. And I think the song to me, and I think it's probably fairly clear, the lyrical content is this guy who's come from wherever Indiana is that Midwest, you know, it's like that punk element in through Duff and just through their attitude.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't glitzy. They did all of the big hair and stuff to begin with and the makeup. I'm not sure it suited them, but they brought something really rough to it and it was awesome. And there's some great mythology, particularly around Slash's gear. You know, he'd hock most of his guitars because of his, you know, sort of hard drug sort of habit at the time. I think it was his manager at the time who'd got him a couple of 1959 style Les Paul copies that are very, you know, sort of now renowned guitar luthier made, Chris Derrick, who sadly passed on. And also he stole some kind of modded Marshall amplifier. No one really knows what it was. It was a JCM 800 style with an extra hot rodded kind of stage to it. But whatever they did in there, it produced this really dirty but dry sound, and it was really crisp, and it just, it worked perfectly for the whole album. I read that Slash had one of his roadies had taken it to a session where they'd stolen, you know, from the guys that they'd stolen it from, and they stole it back, but they've tried to recreate the sound since. And he said, you know, whatever it was, whether it was the studio in the humidity in that room, he's never been able to reclaim that sound. And he used a completely different amp for most of a Silver Jubilee for most of the later records for the usage and stuff. So yeah, it's lost in sort of a time warp, you know. It's one of those things that when you have something that big and that successful and so many people love it, everyone starts analysing all the geekery of it all.
What do you think are the characteristics that make a great opening track?
Yeah, I like a big introduction on stuff. When I write my own stuff, I like to have some atmosphere. And Welcome to the Jungle did that. They had that big opener. I'm never disappointed usually with an album. It's, you know, music's music. But I do like a lead-in to be able to start building that story. Because a lot of albums, they're put together just as separate songs, but quite often you'll arrange them so that you have, like, you know, either a lead single or the opener to their own album starts delivering that story for what the songs are going to say. And I think Welcome to the Jungle did that brilliantly because it really was a case of, right, welcome to the next chapter of LA music.
What's the second track?
This is My Name is Prince by Prince. I was playing in a groove metal band in the early 90s, some like heavy, heavy stuff. But our guitarist was well into his Prince and Jamiroquai. And he got me into both of those, those guys. And Prince, obviously, I'd seen watching Top of the Pops and, you know, the old Grey Whistle Test and that kind of thing.
Nice.
You know, in the 70s and 80s with my dad, you know, MTV was obviously huge by that point and Purple Rain. But this was the album that, to me, I remember seeing this song on MTV, and it was this tiny guy, as we know Prince is, but the guy was an absolute giant within the music world. And this song came on, he was standing on like a police car or some kind of car in a darkened street. I'm sure there were flames somewhere, and he's wearing this gold chain visor. And I was just like, this guy's badass. You know? And, you know, it starts slowly, like you've got that build up again, and then the whole song is unapologetically saying, this is who I am, I'm no better than you, but this is who I am, and if you want to hang out with me, you got to deal with that. By this point in his career, he was huge, but moving into a new phase. I think I'm not as much of a Prince aficionado, but yeah, it was a statement song, and it set the stage quite nicely, I think, for an album that, whether it was designed this way or not, became kind of a rock fantasies opera. I think one of my favorite bits about it is how he incorporates the different elements of music, and particularly guitar. Like he doesn't just throw them in. I try to bust a high note and you hear this shrill guitar, but I bust a string and you hear it just going all out.
Yeah.
The background and stuff. So he draws in everything that he needs at that point and then dumps it and he's off to a new idea. It's just a really cool way of doing stuff that you don't have to stick to this formula for things, that everything has to, you know, once you start a song with a guitar going, you got to keep it going. It's like, nah, I'm just going to bring that in. Right, it's off now. We'll have a rap.
Prince at his nastiest and funkiest by far. For me, this was his last great album. He had moments after this. I mean, this was, 1992? There were moments after this. You know, Musicology was a really good album. I think that was about 2004. But this was the last time that it was like a complete body of work. You know, and like you said, you know, I love the concept that runs through it. It's brilliant. They even incorporated some of that into the videos as well, I think, of like the reporter chasing him around.
This is his most aggressive thing, I think. Yes. There's a couple of other tracks on here that were on the B-side. I don't think we have B-sides anymore.
I know.
Yeah, I think it was Arrogance and there's another song and they're really quite aggressive too, but this really was it. And I think for me, that energy and aggression in music, I absolutely love. I really connect it with it. And then, you know, Welcome to the Jungle is the same, as is most of that album. You could tell his voice is starting to break up and, you know, the lyrics are a bit more hard-hitting. No, it's good. And the other point actually was, I don't know if this was before or after Diamonds and Pearls album.
It was the album after it.
Because I know he was in that dispute with the record company who were keeping him to his contract, which is you have to do so many albums.
Yep.
But he just started churning them out.
Yep.
And I think that's where the quality went. He just burned out through that contract to get out of it so he could have his freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like you say, I think this to me feels like the one that was the last big one where he really put everything into it.
Prince is always one of those people that kind of soaks up all the kind of sort of current music trends. I mean, obviously this came out in 92, so this is kind of like post Public Enemy, NWA. He was like, well, I could do that as well, you know. I can make it harder, I can make it nastier. In a lot of ways, this is the ultimate bragging song.
Totally.
You know, I am Prince and I am funky.
Another point you raise is like, he soaks up music. I think if ever there was a person, at least within my lifetime, that I thought was the living embodiment of music, it was Prince. He just seemed to know it inside out, but he surrounded himself with the best guys too. They were like hardcore, just talking music notation the whole time kind of guys. They knew exactly what they were doing, and it's the kind of knowledge that sometimes can take lifetimes to build up, you know, what they knew. But my wife Tash and I, we went to the O2 a couple of years ago because they had the Prince exhibition there. We get the whole guitar, but of course you have to wear gloves and that kind of stuff, and just looking around it, you could see all of his changes. Like you were saying, he just soaks up those kind of those vibes from different bits, or creates new vibes, particularly in the early days. He kind of drove a lot of that stuff. But you could see it as you go around, even just looking at his outfits and his guitar styles and stuff. And then they did a big old piece on Paisley Park where people just come and jam all night. And he'd just stick up a poster or something and say, come and jam tonight. And the whole place would be full of musicians just jamming all night. And then he'd make pancakes in the morning. I'm like, Prince is getting up. Or rather, he's still awake and he's making everything case.
Sorry, one last thing on My Name is Prince. I did read somewhere that some of the lyrics were kind of pot shots being fired at Michael Jackson.
Really?
Yeah, I've heard this rumour that one of the original lyrics for the song was going to be, you must first be a prince before you become a king.
Yes, yeah. And isn't there something like "Who Wants to Be King Anyway"?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's all aimed at MJ. So,
oh wow! Yeah. Okay, that makes total sense. Yeah. Oh, fantastic! Right, that gives a whole new spin on it. I'll go back and reread those.
Is the intro as we know it when we were first obsessing over music when we were younger? Do you think that's something that's been lost in the digital age?
That's a really good question, because when I was younger, you didn't have the glut of music that you can have access to. You, with Spotify, you've got the world there, right? We had to carefully choose an album that we loved. Then you'd spend your hard-earned money on it. And when you're 14, 15, you know, that's pocket money for a couple of weeks at least.
It was an investment.
It really was. And that's why you shared it with your friends.
Like the intro as we knew them, be that insert track with an incredible intro, be that, I don't know, Decadence Dance by Extreme or Shine On You Crazy Diamond. Is that kind of thing lost in the digital age? I kind of mean it like, you know, with the artists who are big today. So, you know, your mainstream pop artists, your Dua Lipas, etc. Because there is so much distraction on things like Spotify, you know, that you can't listen to like half a song without you being bombarded with like, listen to this, like, you will like this, you'll love this, try this. For me personally, I think the attention span for music has kind of gone.
Yes.
With the next generation, you know, maybe I'm just sounding like an old fogey.
I do think you're onto something there, because my listening habits have changed. Yeah. I actually had this chat with Noah Gunnison. He was like, how do you find new music? How do you listen to music? And when I listen to vinyl, I can't be bothered to get up and change it until that side's done. And then I'll flip it over and do the other one, you know. But if I'm sitting there working or writing or whatever it is I'm doing and I'm listening to Spotify, I'll go, okay, cool. Oh yeah, now I want to listen to this. And it's so easy to change it. You don't have to wait for a CD player to come out and go and get your CD and pop it back in, or tape or rewind it to the start of the album, you know, that kind of thing. And so I don't know whether it's a patience thing, the fact that there is so much there. I mean, I still have many, many crates of vinyl, but I don't listen to it as much because it's more of an effort, it's more of an experience. So when I do, it's, you know, it feels special. But that's how it always used to be.
Yeah.
I got my first record player or something when I was about 5 or 6, and we always had a little tape deck around, and, you know, the Muppets album.
Yeah. Brilliant.
And I think you're right. It's so easy to flick through or just go, oh yeah, I'll listen to a couple of these songs and move on. And actually, I don't think you listen to an album as often in its entirety, and therefore you might just skip to the track or tracks that you want to listen to, skipping the intro and losing that experience.
So all right, you ready for choice number three?
This one, I'd followed this band pretty much from their first single through MTV's Headbangers Ball. This is the album that is, I think, another perfect album. And really, not only did they find their place musically, but they found the tone of their content. And also, it was a little bit looking into the glass to see what their future was going to become, right? And so this song is by Alice in Chains. It's off their second full album called Dirt. And the song is called Them Bones.
Kerrang's album of the year, 1992, and justifiably so.
Yeah, one of my top favourite albums of all time. To me, it's a similar one to Appetite, because it has that sound throughout. This one has hardly any build up.
No, it's just bang straight in.
This heavy chugging riff that is a bit disconcerting and off putting because it's in a 7/8 timing. So they're dropping, you know, half a beat or whatever it is. You're trying to play along. You're like, hang on, what are you doing there? It's dropped down. So they're already dropped down a semitone anyway, and then they low drop the E string to give you that. That's your sort of C sharp kind of level, and so it's heavy. And then with the vocal sounds that both Jerry Cantrell and Layne Staley had, you know, Jerry's quite soft kind of voice, and then Layne Staley's harsher but almost hollow kind of sounding.
It still gives me chills listening to anything off this album now. Yeah. It's the first time I ever heard this song when they were on Jules Holland. Incredible, absolutely. And I remember going to buy the album not long after that on tape and completely being obsessed with it.
They catch hold of you, they get stuck in your head, they're like a proper sort of earworm. But so are the guitar solos. Every solo that Jerry Cantrell plays, you can sing more or less.
He's
all about melody. Even though you've got this huge riffs going on, you know, it's just some powerful stuff. And then the song is there. The actual tune is paramount.
He has his incredible ear for for pop melodies. I mean, you know, I mean, he grew up being like a massive Kiss fan.
Yes.
You know, that pop nouse was there, always there in his head. It was always about, you can have the skull-crushing Sabbath riffs, but it's those wonderful pop melodies, as evidenced by, you know, they legit charting singles. I mean, this got to number 26 in the singles chart, you know, this song. Yeah, so it was like a genuine pop hit, which is crazy. You know, those melodies are undeniable. They're undeniable. Like you said, you can even sing along to the guitar solos.
Yeah, everything. I think this was their opening song, if I'm not wrong. I went to see them at Brixton in 93. They had these huge sheets, white sheets, from floor to ceiling on the stage, and you could just see these shadows behind, and then those curtains, those sheets dropped, and there's this huge, like, rigging kind of style netting across, and Lane was up in the air with blue hair, doing the old kind of start to this song, and it was just mad. It was just like, this guy's crazy.
That's unbelievable. Yeah.
And bless him, he struggled, and you could see that in his lyrical content. You know, this song pretty much was a sort of a portent of his own death. He's talking about dying, and then in the last verse, oh, it's happened, I've paid my price, I'm dead, you know. And to me, that was the downward trajectory of all of their songs. He went downhill, and it was rough to see. But when you're a mixed up 18-year-old, or you know, whatever, you know, it kind of made you connect with it. Yeah.
But there was also, you know, looking back, it was almost a crushing kind of inevitability that Lane was going to go.
And I remember the day that happened. I was in the lab at work at the hospital making chemotherapy, and it just came over the news over there. I mean, I remember a few times where my heroes have died, you know, like, so Kurt Cobain, I was in my bedroom watching MTV and it came on there. And this, I was in a lab at work making chemo, and it came over the news that his body had been found, and it was just like, oh, just remember just being crushed. It was rubbish.
I'd like to think that, like, albums like Dirt will be constantly rediscovered by each coming generation. Yeah. I do genuinely think that it's that, you know, it's kind of that, it's up there with, you know, albums of that era, you know, be that, you know, In Utero, Super Unknown, Dirt.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely, it's timeless. I mean, Darkness has never sounded so beautiful.
That's such a good way of putting it. I totally agree. I mean, I used to get so depressed listening to this.
I completely, man. I mean, final thoughts on Alice in Chains. What are your thoughts of William Duvall?
I like him. I thought the first album that they came back with, Black Gives Way to Blue, Utter Depression Gives Away to Sadness, and it was such a wonderful homage to Lane and the band finding their way through grief. Really, they must have seen it coming for years, but then when it arrives, it's still a horrible road to go down. And I thought they did good. Duval, I've got one of his albums for his previous band, Comes With a Fool, and you can hear his voice is very good. It's not dissimilar to Lane's, and it mixes really well with Cantrell's voice, you know.
Completely
hard, sort of breaks up kind of thing, whereas Cantrell, as I said, is that softer, smoother kind of vibe, and that mix is just lovely, the way they harmonize. But yeah, no, I think he's solid. I've seen them more times than I saw, you know, the original lineup. I think it's good. It's, you know, it's not what it was, but it's something new and it's different and it's good. You know, when a front man dies, it's so hard to continue. Or a frontman changes. Van Halen, AC/DC.
Just want to touch on something you spoke about earlier when you were talking about, you know, your crates of vinyl.
Oh, yeah.
And things like that. Do you still enjoy listening to an album from start to finish? I know you were saying about when you're on Spotify, you kind of like pick and choose. I want to listen to this song, that album, da da da. You know, for me personally, I still see it as a real treat to sit down, put the needle on, and listen to an album from start to finish.
Yeah.
You know, I still get a real kick out of that. Do you still do that?
I do. I don't maybe do it as much as I'd like. I have a bunch of playlists of similar vibe stuff. If I want to be in the mood when I'm writing my book or something like that, then I'll put that on because it gets me in the mood. I find with family life, because I've got two teenage boys, you know, when they're over, we tend to do stuff as a family, you know, watch stuff or play board games and that kind of stuff.
Of course.
So there's less time to do that kind of thing. And when I'm working, I can't, because I'm so absorbed in the science of stuff, I can't pay as much attention. So I get something, usually if I'm working on something hardcore, I want something like Pantera. Because there's no melody, there's no distraction, it's just rhythm. It really is something quite special now when you can sit down and put the record player on.
Track four, mate.
It's Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze off of the album Are You Experienced. And it was my first real introduction to Jimmy. And it's this weird psychedelic rock song, you know, that at the time was way out there. Apparently, when they first recorded it, it was something like ridiculous, like 10 or 12 minutes long. And then the producer edited it down to a song that made sense. You know, it starts off with this weird, disjointed, but then it comes in and the amazing song emerges with these sounds that at the time were pretty new. I think he was playing through a Marshall and he was playing through one of the newer fuzz faces, fuzz pedals, which was a development from the original fuzz pedal that old Keith Richards used for Satisfaction. And so this was a silicon version of that. And it's harsher, sharper, bit muddier kind of sound. It was just this amazing song and this odd note choice. It wasn't blues. It didn't make sense to my ear when we were playing it. Yeah, it was just great fun. And so I thought that was a great introduction to an album that I think has gone down as one of the all-time greats.
I'd heard Pet Sounds, I'd heard Sgt. Pepper, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, rock music was kind of progressing at an insanely fast pace, right? And then you hear of this guy coming over to the UK, just ripping up the rule book, really.
You know, we had the British blues explosion where people were revisiting the blues artists of like the 30s who were guys who were blue collar worker guys in the US, and a lot of them went back to their previous jobs, you know, whether that was out on working in farms or warehouses and that kind of thing. They'd had their moment in the sun with blues. And then that scene had sort of done its thing and morphed into rock and roll. And it wasn't until people like Clapton and John Mayall and, you know, those kind of guys, and the Stones, because a lot of their first things were old blues covers, brought it back to life, that those guys had second careers, you know. It impacted that side of thing. The inventors, you know, were suddenly hip again and out doing stuff. But then, as you say, Hendrix lands and he's like, nah. You know, I can play the blues, but I'm also going to do this psychedelic thing where I just throw everyone off. The note choice, how he expressed the rhythms, the melodies and stuff, it was all over.
And pushing the studio to its absolute limit as well. If you, you know, if you really kind of like properly deconstruct Purple Haze, the amount of stuff that's going on in the background, all those kind of whooshes and whoosh kind of noises, the kind of stuff where they were putting, like, you know, headphones or microphones to kind of to get that kind of far, near yet far away kind of vocal effect. Just incredible kind of out of the box thinking. I mean, I know a lot of it is who produced Hendrix stuff. Was it Chas Chandler?
I think it was. He found him, and I think he worked with a young and up and coming producer and sound tech who was doing all of that crazy stuff. Just put them together. He said, right, you know, I've seen you play, you're doing this back in London. And I think they recorded it in London.
Because there's that incredible story of obviously Chas Chandler was the bass player in the Animals.
Yes.
And I heard that he sold his bass to pay for Jimmy's air ticket.
Wow. Okay, you've got to believe in someone to sell your gear.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right.
And I think the interesting thing about Jimmy is, like, there's a couple of bits. One is I've heard that he wasn't always on it. I've heard a lot of people who are alive today who saw him or were around him. When he was on it, there was nothing that could touch him. Quite often, he was not on it at all. And I don't know whether that's down to narcotics or, you know, or whatever. Or confidence, or, you know what it's like when you're playing. Sometimes nights you're just not going to have, you know, you're up there improvising at a jam and it's like, that's not going to happen tonight. And then some nights you surprise yourself. He had those kind of moments, and he also had a lot of insecurities. I read that for the making of this album, they built almost like a room within a room for him to go and do his vocal stuff. Sound of his voice.
He hated his own voice. He hated his singing voice, didn't he? Which is crazy, because I think it's one of the most individual, wonderful, pure singing voices I've ever heard in rock music.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we all appreciate beautiful voices. You've got, I mean, there are Ella Fitzgerald or whoever, Adele or whoever it is, where they can sing perfectly, perfect pitch.
You know,
Mike Patton with his 6-octave range, just bang on the whole time, and so diverse. And then you've got guys who just have unique sounding voices, like Hendrix. And actually, I think Kings of Leon, when they first started, he wasn't a great singer. No. But he had a unique sound.
It worked, though. It works.
The tone and, yeah, the sound of an instrument or a voice is what it makes it appealing. It doesn't matter what they're doing. You know what I mean? So, it's a shame that he didn't quite see that. But then I guess he never found a singer or didn't want to hand over control or whatever.
I think that was the thing. That was the thing. He didn't want to hand over the control.
Because it's kind of like, I sort of agree with that as someone... Mm. Who works on technical documents and does some art little bits as a side thing. It's like, I really stick with the old adage that a camel is a horse designed by committee. It's like you start off with this pure vision of a horse and it's beautiful and stunning and it works perfectly. And then a committee gets involved and go, yeah, let's give him a backpack and let's give him some different type of feet for multi-terrains and let's make him flob on people. And it dilutes that original vision. And I think Hendrix, in a lot of ways, had his original vision. I know that people did, particularly on this track, muck around with it, but I think it still probably retains a lot of its original vision in what it sounds, and it sets up the album perfectly, because if you start off with an album that goes and then you're off into this wonderland of different sounds and songs and noises, it was just a brilliant set up for that album.
One of the things I've always loved about this song, it has one of the greatest misheard lyrics
yes,
of all time. Yeah, is it the sky or this guy?
Yeah. And it's so easy to hear this guy.
I know. I can never unhear that. Just one little thing before we go on to your last choice. I just want to say that obviously we can't play any songs through the podcast due to the copyright police. But what we do, an accompanying Spotify playlist to go along with each episode. Have a listen to the songs that Michael has very generously chosen for the podcast today. Yeah, without further ado, mate, what's your final choice?
My final choice, and this was the one I was dallying with between Black Sabbath song and this one had to win purely for the boots on the front cover of the album, is Rick James's Give It To Me Baby off of the Street Songs album. Honestly, from the second that this almost walking funky bass line comes in, you're like, his charisma just flows out of it. It's just, I love it. And it sets the album up perfectly. There's some great funk and kind of pop songs and bits and pieces on here, but this is probably my favourite. I think this is the strongest track.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, it is. It's a heck of a way to start. I mean, just pure, dirty, disco, funk, pop. You know, with the gnarliest dude at the front of it. You know, front and centre, Rick James. Incredible, incredible player. I think this is one of those rare songs where I will get up and dance to it.
I will do that unashamedly.
Yeah, to this, definitely. I think it's the rule.
Yeah, I set up a covers band a couple of years ago, and this is one of the songs that we attempted, and it's actually a lot harder to do. The groove alone, to sit on that groove in that pocket and get it right. It works so well. But because he's got this like this history of being this party dude. I mean, we've all seen the Dave Chappelle.
Yeah. I was going to bring that up. Yeah. Yes, I'm glad you did.
I'm Rick James, bitch. Enjoy it.
Hold my drink, bitch.
Yeah, and the whole cocaine's a hell of a drug. But the guy could play. He could move. Yeah. He just had this real vision, and it's just mad. Yeah, I love it. It's a brilliant, brilliant potty tune. It just makes you want to tap your foot at the very least.
Yeah. I hadn't listened to the Street Sounds album in quite a while, and I'd forgotten how strong the album is. It's a great album. Obviously, yes, this is the best song. Obviously, the most well known song is Super Freak. Obviously, as a result of
MC Hammer.
That's it. This tune, it's an undeniable pop disco funk banger.
It is, and it was at a time when disco was it on its way out by this point?
Yes, it was. This was 1980. So yeah, disco was pretty much dead. It was kind of bringing it. It was still disco, kind of unashamedly disco. I think it had that awesome funk element, the funkadelic and the Parliament, Bootsy Collins kind of. And it was a bit more, dare I say it, street. There was a bit of darkness to it. It wasn't just all kind of sugary Bee Gees, Gloria Gaynor kind of thing. There was a bit more street, back alley darkness to Rick James's stuff.
Yeah, he sort of trod this careful line between that, but still being very accessible.
Yeah, very pop. Very pop.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I think that pop sensibility set him apart from Bootsy Collins' sort of other projects.
Completely.
And, you know, those kind of guys, they were great, but maybe on quite a few levels, nowhere near as accessible as Rick's stuff.
All the songs on this album are like 3 minutes. Tailor-made for radio at the time, you know, pop, mainstream pop radio. Rick James, he kind of took that template, mixed it with some disco, with brilliant, undeniable pop hooks, and of course he was going to be a huge star. And he looked incredible, and he looked so cool.
Oh, dude, he's the coolest. Only your listeners need to go and check out the album cover, because I want a pair of those boots, man. And
yeah.
I mean, disco, as much as it's slated as being candy floss and that kind of thing, it really was part of a social movement in a not dissimilar way to 1950s rock and roll. You know, it was loosening some of the constrictions of maybe much more conservative America and that kind of thing. It very much, I don't know if you've ever seen RuPaul's Drag Race. I mean, they as a time where there was much post the hippie movement, or, you know, following on from that, where there was much more acceptance of difference. You know, and Rick really was part of that, because he was to wear those boots, you know, and do what he did in his videos and think about what he was singing about. It really was a case of being part of that movement of just going, I'm just going to be this. I'm going to put it all out there. And I don't care what you think. No. The fact that I'm wearing these boots that you think, you know, are maybe a bit silly or whatever, or, you know, maybe harsher language than that. Yeah. I don't care. Because I'm having the best time. And it really was part of a social movement, so much so that the Disco Sucks movement, which was generated by the conservatives, really tried to discredit it and bring it down and end it. But I don't think they could. Studio 54 was massive, and, you know, the funk thing really drove it through. Yeah, I love a bit of disco. I used to do a little bit of disco DJing myself back in the day.
Nice.
Despite the fact I was playing in bands that were like Pantera and Sepultura.
Yeah.
I don't care. I love it all, man.
That's it. You know, the best way to be is multifaceted. And in terms of what you're into with music, man, there should be no boundaries.
No, I think this sets, you know, getting back to the point of this, is it sets the album up beautifully. You've got a mix of everything there, like you said. You know what this album's going to be: pop and funk and you know, disco and stuff all the way through. And there'll be elements of more concentrated in some songs than others, but this was just awesome.
Mike, it's been fantastic, mate. That's been a wonderful, wonderful chat. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you as well, guys. I mean, this is, I've been looking forward to just talking about music, and it's, and you're a lovely chap to talk to.
Oh, bless you, mate. Bless you. No, feels good. It's been so lovely catching up with you, mate. It really, really has. Take care, dude.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. Take care.
So there you go. Another cracking chat with some actually cracking song choices. I hope you enjoyed it. And who knows, maybe you've discovered your new musical obsession. So take care of yourselves out there. And we'll catch up on the flip side. Cheers.
I'm feeling kind of basic today. Top 5 side ones. Track ones.
You've been listening to the Track 1 Side 1 podcast with me, Gaz Jones. Give us a follow on all the social medias at Track 1 Side 1 Podcast to keep fully up to date with all future episodes and guests, where there will also be links to Spotify playlists that will accompany each show. So please check them out. And I'll see you soon.